It is a nation whose people are sheep, whose shepherds mislead them off the deep end of history. It is a nation whose leaders are liars, whose bigots haunt the airwaves, preaching more violence. Pity the nation that raises not its voice except to praise conquerors and say there's no choice, and aims to rule the world through force and torture. Pity the nation that knows no language but its own, no culture but its own. Pity the nation whose breath is money and sleeps the sleep of the too well-fed. Pity the nation, oh, pity the people who allow their rights to erode, their freedoms washed away. My country, tears of thee, sweet land of liberty. First they came for the communists, and I said nothing because I could never be a part of that party. Then they came for the unions, and I said not a thing, 'cause I wasn't in a union, and what charges could they bring? Then they came for the Jews, but I did not speak up, because I was not a Jew. And besides, what could one man do? Then they came for me, I said, no, this cannot be. Well, I spoke up, but no one left to speak for me. Yes, I spoke up, but no one was left to speak for me. I didn't fight for the Romans, I fought for the Christians in Greece. When Christians turned into crusaders, I prayed for their tribes to decrease. And I didn't fight for the Spanish, French, Portuguese, or Dutch. When their ships sailed into the Indies, I said, look, but do not touch. And I didn't fight for the English when the colonies had to go. But I have to say, the very next day, I was fighting for Geronimo. And I don't like to kill, never have and never will. But I will fight for freedom, though the battle be uphill. And I don't fight for conquerors, even if they're presidents. They try to buy me with dollars, they must think I've got no sense. And I don't keep my silence when my country bombs a town, 'cause I don't fight for conquerors, I fight to bring them down. I didn't fight for the Ottomans or the Empire of the Tsar. When they asked me to kill in their colonies, I said, who do you think you are? And I didn't fight for the Nazis, no, I fought for the Jews. And when Israel asked me to conquer, you know I had to refuse. I didn't crown the Shah of Iran, Greek colonels or a butcher in Zaire. Didn't bank on Franco or apartheid or any who ruled by fear. And I don't like to kill, never have and never will. But I will fight for freedom, though the battle be uphill. And I don't fight for conquerors, even if they're presidents. They try to buy me with dollars, they must think I've got no sense. And I don't keep my silence when my country bombs a town, 'cause I don't fight for conquerors, I fight to bring them down. I didn't overthrow Chile, slaughter peasants in El Salvador. When they went in with shock and awe, I knew exactly what it was for. I didn't send men to be tortured, leave their families living in dread. I didn't build prisons all over the world and pretend it was freedom I spread. Yes, they say they're spreading democracy, but they're soldiers in the CIA. Is that why they propped up Mr. Marcos, Suharto, Duvalier? In Vietnam and Iraq I protested while all of my presidents lied. When presidents stoop to conquer, I'm on the other side.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind with David K. Johnston and Jane O'Donnell, USA Today Money Reporter.
Just as over 100 years ago, there were communities where Wall Street said, we're not going to wire you for electricity. You're way out in the sticks, or it's not the highest profit margin for us. We're not going to do it. So the towns then created their own municipal systems. And overall, people who get municipal electricity pay about a third less. Mm-hmm. They have fewer outages. They have better service. And by the way, even the big systems like the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, Sacramento, these really big systems, they pay figure salaries to their top executive that are in six figures, as opposed to some of the private corporate utilities now that are paying $30, $40 million a year for the same service, and people pay higher prices. So the market sometimes is less efficient than local government focused on the betterment of a community.
Were there other examples? It seems to me there might have been other examples of these kinds of companies, upstart companies, being far more competitive and helping consumers more.
Well, there was an outfit that tried in Sacramento, California, to start building a system, and immediately AT&T cut prices way down to nothing. And the Supreme Court is very hostile to this notion of predatory pricing because it makes the assumption that you would have to cut prices everywhere. You don't do that. You just cut prices in one location, and you take those losses till you run the competitor out of business, and you keep them out of business by doing that. And that's why we see very little real competition in this area. Now, if I can shift gears on you a little bit.
Sure.
I live in Rochester, New York, a few blocks outside the city in a suburb. My neighbors and I voted to raise our property taxes. And today, because of that, I have more money in my pocket. And it's a good example of market economics are not as simple as you would think from what you hear in most television shows. In the U.S., we have an oligopoly of garbage companies that charge tremendously high prices. And I show how they tell the government, oh, we're in a tightly competitive market. But they tell the stock market touts in recorded conversations that I quote, oh, hey, we got this fixed. We know how to, what they call, rationalize the market, get rid of competition, raise prices. We're even pushing our competitors who don't want to raise prices to raise prices. Now, how did we raise taxes in my neighborhood and cut prices? Well, we had about eight different garbage companies. And every day of the week, a different smelly diesel truck would come down the street, and there'd be a trash can on the street. We created a refuse district. Then we went to competitive bid. We got the lowest price. One day a week, one truck, every single house on the street. And my bill for garbage collection went from around $600 a year in today's dollars down to less than half of that. So although I pay higher taxes, I have more money in my pocket. Mm-hmm. Paying higher taxes can actually make you richer. It depends on how the money is spent. It can make you poorer, but it can also sometimes make you wealthier.
A perfect example of how consumers can make a difference, right?
Absolutely, in
their own life.
Absolutely, we took action to create this district. And I tell the story of my neighbors who did the hard work to make this happen.
One of your solutions in the utility chapter was interesting, kind of counterintuitive, like what you were just describing. Eliminating the corporate income tax on utilities will end the blatant legalized theft of billions of dollars of consumers from consumers from PSEG, which is the PSEG.
That's the PSEG is a utility in New Jersey,
of
the biggest in New Jersey.
But what could you explain that? How eliminating the corporate tax income tax?
Well, PSEG, let me deal with their specifics first, because this happened all over the country. Half the states voted to get rid of the traditional integrated utility. It generated electricity in a power plant, transmitted it, and then distributed it to homes and offices, and ran the whole thing top to bottom. Mm-hmm. In the half of states where we got rid of that and said, well, no, we're going to have you buy it in the open market, prices have gone like this. They're up about 48% in real terms since 1999 after you adjust for inflation. And this is a case of the market rules are actually designed to raise prices, not to lower prices. PSE&G was one of the companies that was told you have to get rid of your power plants. So did they have an open auction and sell them in the market? No. They transferred them from their regulated utility pocket to an unregulated pocket. So the same power plants burning the same fuel in the same locations, supply electricity to the same people in the same businesses, but now the company buys it from itself. Well, when they did this, the companies had already written off the most of the value of these plants. Mm-hmm. And there's something called an accumulated income tax deferral account that as these plants have been written down in advance, eventually this money gets paid back to the government. So it's sort of an interest-free loan. You write it off today, you pay the taxes in the future. Wouldn't you like to have the interest on, say, $1 billion for the next 10 years?
Very nice.
Yeah, well, when the state of New Jersey did this, and I believe most of the other states, including especially Pennsylvania, they forgot about the account. They said, oh, these plants are being sold at an increased price, even though they're only being transferred to the same company. They owe income taxes on the gain because they already wrote them off. So they made customers pay what's called stranded costs that included income taxes. They borrowed money, and you have to pay interest, therefore,
on
that.
The customers are paying.
The customers are paying. So the customers are paying twice for this income tax, and the company got to pocket the money. And PSEG has never denied this. They've always said, oh, this is a settled matter. We're not going to discuss this anymore. It's over. They've been very careful to never deny they pocketed all this money. Now, the second part of this is that utility companies often have what's called a holding company structure. So you have your local utility you write a bill to for your electric, water, natural gas, but it's actually owned by another company up here. And increasingly, they're owned by companies in Spain and France because European rules are very favorable to making profits. These companies up here mostly operate with borrowed money. So the utility makes a profit of 11% after taxes, but the company up here actually makes maybe 30%. And those taxes, fully charged to you at the highest possible rate, in many cases never get to the government. It's not that they're delayed. It's not the 10-year loan of the interest on the $1 billion. But the holding company is able to set up a mechanism where it gets the money and the federal government, the state government, never see this money. Now, when I exposed this back in 2002, I think it was, when I was at the New York Times, Oregon passed a law that said, hey, you collect the tax, you either give it to the government or you give it back to the customers. Portland General Electric, which has been owned by Enron, no problem. Northwest Natural Gas, the local gas utility, no problem. A company called PacifiCorp, owned by Warren Buffett, immediately went to the legislature and said, that's not fair, we have to stop this, and they eventually got it overturned. And what really goes on now is Warren Buffett's utility collects the rates, they collect the income tax, and there's no evidence that that income tax ever gets to the government, and therefore the company earns more than it's supposed to earn. And this undoes a principle in the law called just and reasonable for monopolies. The owners of a monopoly should earn a just and reasonable profit. If they don't make a profit, they're not going to maintain the system. The customers should pay a just and reasonable price. But if you say the just and reasonable price is X, and then you throw in this income tax and the company pockets it, now it's an unjust and unreasonable price. The consumers are losing, the company is gaining. It violates the underlying standard for regulation. And, you know, it's an enormous amount of money. The average electric bill, it's about 5% of your bill, is these taxes. If you can collect one penny a day from everyone in America, at the end of the year, you'll have $1.1 billion. Wow. Well, what if you can collect $1 a day? Now you got $111 billion. And it doesn't take a lot of these deals in a lot of different industries before suddenly you and I aren't doing so well, but there's a handful of people who are doing extraordinarily well.
Extraordinarily well. And one of the statistics that really jumped out at me was the one that says from 1983 to 2010, the number of Americans rose 36%, but the number of utility workers fell 15%. Right. Now, that, of course, comes to mind. I don't know if this area in Washington, D.C. is any worse, but every time there's a storm, we lose power, and we lose it for a long time. A friend of mine who's been a foreign correspondent for a long time said that he feels like he's in a third world country here. He's losing power so much.
Pepco, which is the Washington, D.C. corporate utility, and which gets, by the way, about 18% of its money from the taxpayers, including the taxes that are supposed to go back to the government, is the champion of tax avoidance in American corporations.
Wow.
They are better at it than General Electric. Okay,
wow.
They are really good at it. I have gone back for years through their records. I've met and talked with them. They set up these holding company mechanisms above Pepco so they make money off the tax system. They are also one of the worst utilities in America when it comes to service. And I wrote about this some years ago. The Washington Post did a big investigation about it because it got to be so bad. By the way, municipal systems generally have extraordinarily good service records because they're run as a public service for the community rather than to make a profit. And So Pepco is not unusual in that regard, but they're worse than that. I go through the book and I show how these utilities are being hollowed out. They largely people who are career utility people, and I'm clearly no fan of monopolies here, all right? Yeah. But who understood they had to run the businesses well in terms of service have been replaced by financial folks, and they've been hollowing out these utilities. So in California, Pacific Gas and Electric got rate increases so it could replace power poles on a 50-year cycle. That's reasonable. Their own testimony is power poles on average last 50 years. A few will last more than 100. A few will last 40. On average, 50 years. So after they get the rate increase to pay for this, they replaced poles on a 775-year cycle. They put up not 46,000 poles a year, but about 3,000 poles a year. And so there are power poles today that, if nothing changes, supposedly will have to last till, I think it's 2775.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Now, if you're a competitive business and you do that, you don't reinvest in the business. You don't replace equipment as it wears out. You go broke. But if you're a monopoly utility, when the disaster comes, when a bunch of power poles collapse, you run to the government, say, we need an emergency rate increase. And if you've managed to get the legislature under deregulation to get rid of the utility staff that's supposed to stand up for the public, and if you've managed to get rules in place, like the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has done, that basically say, you can't challenge anything we do. There's a fight going on right now about that, where they just dismiss, without any discussion, challenges to their practices. And there are pipelines, by the way, out there that they regulate that are earning over 50% annual profits. And they've given them a 38% rate increase over 5 years. What you do is you get this rate increase, and then if there's nobody watching, it becomes a permanent rate increase. So the executives today get to report higher profits than they were really earning on an economic basis, and therefore more money from their stock options. And in the future, those executives will do just fine because they'll get more money. And who loses? The customers.
Well, did the public outcries that happen after these, you know, mass blackouts, do they make a difference, or is it just kind of, you know, they pay a lot of attention and give lip service? And
I don't think so. I think this is a real fundamental problem, Jane. The utility boards are really insulated. When I first wrote about public utilities in the early 1970s, the utility boards that I dealt with, they at least had some people who weren't directly connected to the industry. Sometimes they had knowledgeable critics. The California Public Utilities Commission had a brilliant businessman named Bob Batinovich, who just died recently and probably had made himself a billionaire before he died, who were critics of the industry and who thought about how do we get the rules to encourage the utilities to behave in a way that best benefits the overall economy. Well, California Public Utilities Commission, under Governor Schwarzenegger, was run by people from the utility industry. The former head of California Edison, a lawyer for the cell phone industry, a financier from the energy industry. And I quote the editor of a little paper in California, the only paper in California besides the LA Times that's been tough on the utility industry, Dennis Wyatt at the Manteca Bulletin, who says PUC doesn't stand for Public Utility Commission because they are so in the pocket of the industry. Profits. He calls it the Profits Upkeep Commission.
Right. There's so many other examples that are interesting to me, but certainly let you get into a couple that I didn't mention. But, you know, the section on 401ks and retirement savings, you know, what do you find most compelling? What would you like to talk about briefly? But also, you know, is there a lesson in there that what we can do as individuals?
I call them 201ks because most people, you know, if everybody knew how to invest money well, then the average job on Wall Street would pay average wages.
Right.
I mean, it's absurd. I mean, for all of my education and knowledge, and I went to the Chicago School, though I'm not an economist and I've written about finance for years, I'm not really a good investor. I don't really know how to do that. I just know spend less than you make. The efficient way to take care of people's old age, which there's no escaping, is through defined benefit pension plans. And you're hearing industry saying, oh, we have to get rid of these. They're not predictable. We don't know what to do. That's nonsense. You can buy an individual defined benefit pension plan tomorrow. Call up any insurance company, say, I'm this age. I want money at this age. Here's how much I have. And tell them your gender and get a blood test. And they'll say, we'll give you so much a month for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. When you do it with large numbers of people, it's very easy to do. So what went wrong? Companies, after the Employee Retirement Income Security Act was passed in 1974, went to Congress and they kept getting this little change and this little change and this little change to not put in the appropriate amount of money. We know how much to put in. This is not a secret. We've had pensions going back 400 and 500 years. But by getting all these little rules, and who pays attention in the news media to these little rules? Can you imagine going to the editors of USA Today and say, hey, there's this little rule called subsection 14B11,
I covered pensions
paragraph C, and they're trying to rewrite the order of the conjunctions in it.
That's not going to play too well.
Not going to play. So they get these rules rewritten to underfund these things
right. And
to raid them. I have a pension that's been thoroughly raided and probably will die before I do. So 201K, 401Ks, 201Ks are an accident of history. They were an effort by one industry, financial services, to allow executives to save extra money. And it blew up into this big, huge system. We need to have a rational policy that recognizes that people need to have money put away for their old age and have a dependable, reliable income stream, not run out of money. By the way, the average worker in America retiring doesn't have anywhere near enough money to be able to go on. So what you're going to see is more and more people in their 70s and 80s working. Maybe that's a good thing for those who can work. I don't plan to ever retire. But what about my brother, who spent his life as a ditch digger? The reason people could get to work on a rainy day was he was down in the culvert getting the tree out of there so the road didn't flood. He's disabled now from that. He's busted up. He can't work. Mm-hmm. We have to think about the system, not about our individual situation.
Right. What are some of the, well, is there any other, is there an issue I didn't touch on?
Oh, there's so many. We could do hours and hours of this because
we have a little more. I
spent 4 years digging this stuff out.
How about, we got Wells Fargo, we got giving to Goldman's.
Well, let me quickly do Goldman and Wells Fargo because there's.
Okay.
When Detroit was bailed out by Washington, everybody took a haircut. The CEO and the janitor took a haircut. The executives lost half their deferred non-government guaranteed pensions. When Wall Street was bailed out by the previous administration, nothing changed. And now a lot of people have heard the story of how Goldman Sachs had $13 billion, about a third of its capital, with AIG, and it made a bad bet that probably would have paid off on pennies on the dollar. They would have lost maybe 10 or 12 billion of that, maybe all of it. Instead, in a meeting of government leaders, including the Treasury Secretary, who just happened to be the former chairman of Goldman, and the one non-government person in the room, the current chairman of Goldman, they made a decision that led to 100 cents on the dollar being paid to Goldman. The government thoroughly bailed Goldman out. There's another deal Goldman made that I go through the analysis of and show was effectively a $5 billion gift to Goldman. Goldman just built a new headquarters. You won't find its name on the building. How'd they build it? Your taxpayer dollars, in large part, paid for that building. If your taxpayers are paying your bills, it's pretty easy to make a profit. And so that's one of the things that has been minimally explored in the news media. And then the Wells Fargo example deals with a woman here in Washington, D.C., a bus driver, school bus driver. She needed to buy a new car. She got talked into paying three times the value of a used car by a car salesman. Wells Fargo financed the deal. She would have paid almost $30,000 for a $6,000 car with interest. She got pregnant and had to go on disability. She tried to give the car back. They wouldn't take it back. And Wells Fargo said, well, we're going to take your house. And under the arbitration agreement that everybody signs, you sign up for a bank account, a brokerage account, buy an appliance, you give up your right to sue and you're put into arbitration. They had all the cards. And if you go to arbitration, you might do that once in your life. But the arbiters know that it's the bank and the car dealer and the other companies, they come to you every day. And so there's what's called the repeat player problem. Mm-hmm. They have an economic interest in making happy the people you're up against because right. They're going to hire them again and again. Two law students at American University took this case, very creatively ran with it. Ultimately, the woman didn't have to pay, and Wells Fargo actually paid some kind of damage. But what did Wells Fargo say to this single mother? We'll take your house. And all of this is because of the 1925 Federal Arbitration Act, which probably nobody listening to this audience has ever heard of. It was passed so that companies that had disputes across state lines and that wanted to go to arbitration had the option of doing so. The Supreme Court, particularly the people I call the radical, ahistorical members of the Supreme Court, Scalia, Thomas, John Glover, Roberts, have twisted and extended and expanded this thing to be an anti-consumer law because they're corporatists and they do numerous things that have no basis in history or the Constitution while claiming that that's their guide.
Bin Laden was George Sr.'s clan not so long ago. Set George up with a retirement plan, lots of low-tax dough. Go down White House, way down in payoff land. Tell the CIA, leave the Saudis alone. There's oil and gas in Uzbekistan. Oil and gas must flow. So we depose the Taliban. Where'd Osama go? Bend down, Congress, kneel down and lend a hand, tell the people liberty must go. There's more to gain in war than peace. Let the weapons flow. Destabilize the Middle East. Enrich the CEO. Go down, brother, way down on Florida sand. Tell the justices not to let my people vote. The VP had a heart attack, oily blood, you know. While he's still here, let's bomb Iraq, give the rubes a show. Lie down, people, lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go. The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow. Thanks to U.S. troops, it's back today. Only goes to show. Go down Wall Street, sell off my shares today. Tell my broker, put it all in blow.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.